Good morning, everyone. Thank you for being here at this quite early hour, and thank you to Kathleen and Fernando for organizing this session. Can everybody hear me, by the way? I don't really. Yeah, okay. Good. Over the last couple of years, my co-authors and I have been working on quite a few meta-analyses. And what I'd like to do today is highlight a couple of issues we had to deal with and the way that we dealt with these, how we found solutions to the issues we had to deal with. Let's see. Let's start off by saying that we're clearly not the only one doing meta-analysis in agriculture. Just for fun, I typed in Web of Science a couple of days ago the words meta-analysis in agriculture. And this is what comes out. So what you see is that over the last 5 years or so, the amount of published meta-analysis, at least based on these numbers, the amount of meta-analysis in agricultural fields has about doubled, which is a lot. And come to think of it, perhaps this increase is not that surprising, because one of the reasons that meta-analysis has become perhaps so important and popular in agricultural science is that agricultural field experiments are typically characterized by relatively high costs, relatively low replication, typically a field rep of like 3 or 4, which means that in many cases you have relatively high uncertainty. So there's something to gain by trying and combine these data and see if you can reduce uncertainty and perhaps also check whether whether treatment effects vary with the experimental conditions by combining these data. So the example I want to focus on today is an analysis we did last year, Pitelkau et al., which was published in the early this year. And for this analysis, we had the idea to try and summarize all the data that was ever published on side-by-side comparisons of no-till versus conventional till and the differences in crop yield between those two treatments. So we went into the literature and we looked up all the comparisons we could find where for two plots where the only difference between the two plots was the type of tillage that was applied, no-till versus conventional till. The actual approach that we used to search and find these studies and the requirements for study inclusion in the database, if you're interested in that, it's written down in the paper. But the very short version is that we typed the words no-till and yield into Scopus. We hit the search button, and we had to sift through 8,000 to 9,000 papers, which took a lot of work from 7 or 8 people at the same time. So once we did that, we ended up with 5,463 observations. Now, what's the next step? In pretty much every meta-analysis, when you have these observations, you'll have to derive an effect size from those observations and then weight those effect sizes. Because in the very simplest terms, an effect size and a meta-analysis is a weighted average of effect sizes. So in our case, there's several types of effect sizes you can use to try and capture that effect of no-till. But we used the natural log of the response ratio, which is the treatment, the value, the yield that we would find in the treatment plots. So in this case, the no-till plots divided by the yields that we found in the control plot. You take the natural log of that, and that's the number you're working with. And this number, in the end, can be back transformed and reported as a percentage effect. So a percent change in yield with no-till treatment. Now, in conventional meta-analysis, the weight that you would use for these kind of effect sizes would be the inverse of the study variance. You see the formula over here. In this formula, SD is stands for the standard deviation, N for the field reps, and mean, obviously, for the means. If you have the inverse of the study variance, you can weight your different observations, and you can also use that value, that weight, to calculate 95% confidence intervals. Now, this is where we encountered our first problem, and it's a big one. That's that the standard deviations were not available for all studies. Actually, when you try to put it in the percentage, I think maybe for less than 10% of the studies could we find standard deviations. That presents a problem, right? Because we wanted to be all-inclusive. That was our goal. We tried to do a global meta-analysis. So there's a couple of things you can do in a case like this. Well, one of them is that you can limit your analysis to the studies that do report standard deviations, but we decided that was not the way we wanted to go. You can try and estimate missing standard deviations from available data, but even if we did that, we only got a few more percent of available standard deviations. Or a last option, which is trying to use alternative weights. And here's what we did. This is an approach suggested by Hedges and Olken in 1985. Let's have a look again at that weight that I just presented. Now, if we assume in this weight that for all the studies, the ratio of standard deviation over the mean is the same for each experiment, then in that case, the variance of a study, and so the precision of the study, is defined solely by N, the number of field reps. So if in this formula that you see over here, you replace the standard deviation divided by the mean by a fixed number, let's say 1, then that formula collapses to the formula you see below. It's a lot simpler. It's a lot, you lose a lot of information, obviously, but it has some big advantages as well, being that you can include way more studies. Big disadvantage is that this number, this formula at the bottom there, the absolute value of that weight doesn't really mean that much anymore. It's just the difference, the relative value, the difference between studies that tell you how much that particular study will be weighted. With this new weight, we can no longer use the traditional, conventional methods in meta-analysis to calculate the 95% confidence interval, so we have to do something else. And that is bootstrapping. Perhaps quite a few in this room already know about that, but I thought, well, let's make a few slides to explain the concept. Let's say that you have a data set of n effect sizes. You can always easily calculate an average of that number, right? So let's say that we have a data set of 12 numbers. The average, in this case, of those 12 numbers would be 3.5. Now, what you do in with bootstrapping is that you randomly select of that data set n effect sizes with replacement, and then you calculate a new average. So that's what's going on in that middle window over there. And what you end up now as a new average is 4.5. Well, that number 4.5 is the first one of a very long row of numbers because you're going to repeat what I just said a couple of thousand of times. That's what's happening here. And then you arrange those results from low to high. So the 4.5 that you see ends up somewhere in the middle now. Okay, and that's the last step. You remove the top and the bottom 2.5%. That's what's going on here. And then what you're left with is a 95% confidence interval. And if that 95% confidence interval does not include zero, we conclude that the average treatment effect, the treatment effect was significantly different from zero. So that's what we did in our analysis as well. And here are the results. If you take all the data together, all the no-till versus conventional till comparisons, and you calculate this average, you find that on average there's a negative effect of no-till of about minus 6%. And as you can see, the 95% confidence intervals here do not overlap zero, so that effect was significant. However, this is of course not the whole story. There's many studies that also find positive effects of no-till on yield. So we were interested to find out whether we could explain some of the variance in our data set. What factors determined whether or not no-till had positive or mostly negative effects. So what we did here, well, as an example, I'll give you the comparison between four classes of studies, four categories of studies. So in this particular comparison between categories of studies, we were interested in the question whether or not the effect of no-tillage depends on the other conservation agricultural principles. That is, residue retention or crop rotation. So we wanted to compare the effect of no-till in systems that either had those other principles implemented or not. Well, if you end up with two additional principles, you can come up with four different classes that you see lined up over here. Residue retention, yes or no. Crop retention, yes or no. And then on the right-hand side here, you see the number of observations in each of those classes as well. So to try and find out whether or not those four classes differed from one another, we used a technique called randomization. This is how it works. Let's say that you have three experimental classes. One class has an average treatment effect of plus 10, one has an average effect of plus 20, and one has an effect of plus 30, with an overall effect size of the whole population of 20%. Now, how different are those three classes from one another? Well, one way to express the difference is using a homogeneity statistic. Adams et al. Calls this number QB, and as you can see in the formula there, it's the sum of the average class size effect minus the overall effect size, and that number squared for each, and then you add up the values for the three different classes. So in this case, you end up with a QB value of 10 minus 20 squared plus 20 minus 20 squared plus 30 minus 20 squared, which is 200. Now, the next step in your randomization process would be that you randomly assign your observations to the classes you earlier defined. In this case, we just scrambled all the results, and the overall effect size of all the numbers is, of course, still 20, plus 20%. However, in this case, we only find an average effect of plus 15% for class 1, plus 26% of class 2, and plus 19% of class 3. Now, in this case, what's the QB value? Well, you can do the same calculation. It's a lot smaller, as you can see. The number is 52 this time. Well, just as with the bootstrapping, you're going to repeat this process many, many, many times. You randomly assign your observations to a class, and then you calculate this QB value. And the p-value for the differences between the original classes that you defined is then the fraction of the repeats where the QB value is bigger than your original QB value. So this is the approach we took to calculate p-values for differences between the classes that I just talked about. So if you do that, this is the graph you end up with. You can see that the differences between the experimental classes were highly significant. The effect of no-till is the least negative, and in some subclasses even positive. If you also, in systems where you also implement residue retention and crop rotation. And the more of those additional conservation principles you take away, the more negative the effect of no-till becomes. Now, what are some of the pros and the cons of the two techniques that I just showed you? Well, the pro is obviously that it's fairly easy to perform, and I think it's intuitively easy to understand. Another advantage is that the data don't have to be normally distributed, and the biggest one, I think, is that it can be used when standard deviations are not available, which, especially in agricultural research, it seems like, is a big issue. So it really expands the number of studies you can include. Some obvious cons as well. One of them is that, well, you make a lot of assumptions here. So especially for very small data sets, let's say 5 to 10 data points, your 95% confidence intervals become a bit less reliable. And if you want to read about the discussion about the details of why this becomes a bit of a problem, for especially for small data sets, I can recommend the paper by Gurevich and Hatches from 1999 in ecology. There's another issue as well, something I labeled confounding factors. Let's say that you want to compare three different classes of experiments. In this case, residue plus residue minus crop rotation, plus residue plus crop rotation, and the last one, minus residue minus crop rotation. You can calculate, of course, an average effect for all those classes, but now let's say that we know that the classes differ in other ways as well. For instance, the amount of studies in each class that received a high fertilizer N rate. Let's say that the number of studies is different from each class, which is very likely. And now let's assume that high fertilizer rates affect the effect of no-till. In that case, we no longer know, we can no longer be sure anyway, whether the difference between the original classes has something to do with the residue and crop rotation, or whether it has also something to do with your fertilizer rates and the number of studies with high fertilizer rates in each class. Well, possible solution for this problem is linear effect models. Oh, we're still good?
Yeah. Okay. The image disappeared for a second.
Ah, okay.
You didn't see
yeah,
that.
I saw that before as well. Yeah. So that would mean that you would fit a model that looks a bit like this. In this case, your the natural log of your response ratio would be a product of your fertilizer rate, of your residue treatment, of your crop rotation, and of climate. There have been some efforts in this area that have done similar things like this. There's one reference over there, Tolliver et al., in the agronomy journal, I tried this. We tried it as well, but we quickly ran into quite some problems, and that is that one of them was that you have to make quite a few assumptions regarding the distribution of data, and those assumptions were not met in our case. And another thing is that the data on crop rotation, climate, fertilizer, and so on, have to be available for each single observation in your data set, which was not true in our case. So it would seriously limit our data set as well. So for this particular analysis, we kept things a bit simpler, and in the cases where you would decide to keep things a bit simpler as well. Some things that you do need to take into account is, well, the effect that I just pointed out. So check for bias in the composition of your study classes. and also compare treatment effects between classes. For instance, let's see if the effect between these three classes that you see over here, the red, the yellow, and blue, if that effect is similar for the subset of data that received high fertilizer N rates. If that's true, then you can be a bit more certain about your results. Let's see. I'd like to end with well, a few issues that are pretty common in meta-analysis as well. Gurevich and Hatches, 1999, they discuss a lot of them, so I suggest you go there for a lot of details. But many, some important issues are the non-independent observations in your data sets, something that I called mixed treatments, and the representativeness of your primary studies. Well, the first one, let's see, is a big is an important one, because one of the main assumptions in your meta-analysis is that your data in your database are independent observations. And you could argue that data coming from the same experiment are no longer independent. So let's say you have a full factorial design in your experiment and you extract multiple effect sizes, those are no longer independent. Something similar happens when you have multiple time points, multiple yields, for instance, from the same experiment. Are those data independent? We argue in our case that it's not, so we took an average of those numbers, but there are other approaches that might seem more reasonable as well. For instance, if you feel like or you decide that the most recent or the latest measurement in your time series is the most representative. There are more sophisticated methods to deal with these issues as well, especially when there are standard deviations reported. See the reference over here, La Jeunesse. They did something with that. Another small issue is something that I like to call mixed treatments. So in our analysis, we only compared those treatments that the plots that only differed in conventional till and in no-till. All the other factors were the same. Now, what you see pretty often in field experiments is that these treatments are being mixed. For instance, the no-till treatment, in addition to applying no-till, also gets some extra nitrogen. In that case, you can no longer state that the effect you find is solely due to no-till. It's a mixed effect in this case. So we decided to leave these type of experiments out of our data set. And I think it's important to, when you do your analysis, to state these kind of requirements like very explicitly, because they have an important, can have an important impact on your overall result. Well, the final issue then is the question whether or not your primary studies in your database are representative. Publication bias is one issue. It's been talked about a lot by other people, the idea that good studies, so studies that have that produce significant results are more likely to get published, and that might skew your overall effect in your meta-analysis. And then the question whether or not the experiments in your data set are actually representative for your for actual farmland. Experimental stations are pretty often located on prime farmland, whereas actual farmland pretty often is quite different. There's slopes, there's it's not always as well drained. So these are effects that are need to be taken into account. And one way to might do that is include more on-farm, try and conduct more on-farm experiments. Another thing is that you can do is report experimental conditions. So for each study, and that way you can maybe, it becomes easier to extrapolate your data to other environmental conditions as well. And a last point I'd like to point out is that it would help meta-analysis a lot if standard deviation values would be provided for more data points. Now, these are all things that have been suggested 10 years ago already, so this is not something new, and not much changed in the meantime. A couple of words and slides probably won't change this issue either. But on the last slide, I put my email address, and if anybody's interested in brainstorming about the requirements for statistical reporting in agricultural science and write a letter to editorial board of like some main agricultural journals, then I'd be happy to brainstorm with you about that. So my concluding comments here. The approach that you choose in meta-analysis may affect the outcome of your meta-analysis, so describe it very precisely, especially when it comes to how you deal with non-independent observations and the extracting and the defining of your effect sizes. Use your standard deviations whenever you can, but if it's not possible, then the bootstrapping approach that I talked about could be an alternative. And there's this study that was recently published by Philibert et al. In Agriculture, Ecosystems, and Environment that lists 8 components that every proper meta-analysis should do before it gets published. So this is a good reference if you want to have a look at how to perform a proper meta-analysis in agriculture. Yeah, that's all I have, and I'm slightly over time.
Any questions from the audience? We do have a couple of minutes for questions. Yes.
Yeah. Thank you for your nice talk. My name is Marco Deels. I work for Siemens. I have a question regarding the problem with standard deviation. I'm really surprised when you say that only 10% of the publications that you found report on standard deviation.
Yeah.
We know that in peer-reviewed literature, a requirement, a standard requirement, is to indicate whether your treatment affects the city.
Yeah.
So that's my first observation.
Yeah.
No, but then my question is, did you not try to calculate or estimate standard deviation from other statistical information like LSD,
or
when a teacher, in many cases, they indicate whether their treatment is significant? So the differences, the smallest difference, the biggest difference.
Did
you also try to compare your method on a limited data set where you have your LSD with the classical meta analytical approach?
Thanks for your questions. So when it comes to LSD values, we did have a look at that. You can definitely increase the number of your, but even in that case, this is just an estimate, but I think maybe you can double the number of your estimated SD values, and then you end up with 20 or 30% of your data set, which is still not that much, I think. In many cases, you have a p-value, but it says p higher than, 0.05, and then you're kind of lost. Then it becomes kind of hard to derive any standard deviation, I'd argue. But when it comes to the question of the limited data set, we didn't do it in this case, but in some previous meta-analysis, we did. Different question. This was a meta-analysis we did a couple of years ago on the effect of elevated CO2 on soil carbon contents. And then there were a lot more standard deviations available in that case, which made it easier. So in that case, we could combine the two methods, or compare the two methods, the simple method that I just showed you and the conventional method. And it turns out that in that case, at least, the results were very comparable, including the p-value of classes, difference between classes, and the overall treatment effect.
Thank you, Kesh, again.